On this episode of Narcissist Apocalypse, we talk with an abuse survivor named Willow. And Willow was in an abusive relationship with a malignant narcissist. It's a story of control, isolation, failed smear campaigns, and private investigators. Welcome to Narcissist Apocalypse, everyone. This is a podcast that gives a voice to survivors of toxic relationships. I am Brandon Chadwick, but my friends call me Chad, and thanks for tuning into this episode. So what is a narcissist, you may ask? Well, for the purposes of this podcast, we refer to a narcissist as anyone who has displayed a pattern of behavior that shows a limited capacity to appreciate others' perspectives. It is that simple. And now, before we get to our episode with Willow, I just want to tell everyone to go to our website at narcissistapocalypse.com if you want to be a guest on our show. Top of the page is a button that says guest form. Click on that button, fill out the guest form, and we will go from there. Another way to be on our show is to be part of our Letters to My Narcissist compilation episode, Volume 6. And for that, you can also go to narcissistapocalypse.com. Side of the page, there is a floating button that says send voicemail. Press that button, records up to 5 minutes, press it twice, 10 minutes, and away we will go on that one. If you do not want to read the letter yourself and you want me or my old pal Melissa to read the letter instead, just send us an email at narcissistapocalypse@gmail.com and put letters to my narcissist in the subject line. Hey, everyone, guess what? We have a Patreon. Yes, we have a Patreon. If you want to support the show, go to our Patreon at patreon.com/narcissistapocalypse. We have episodes that never made it to air. We have follow-up episodes with former guests. We have virtual support groups that we do every Wednesday and Saturday, and we have our own private message board, forum board, that is away from Facebook. We feel it's safer there. You know, if you want to be part of this, you want to support the show, be part of our community, join our Patreon today. And I'm thanking you in advance for becoming a patron of our Patreon. And now before we get started here, I really want to thank everyone in our community, and I want to thank Willow for taking part on the show. This is a very difficult episode for her to record. You know, she's been through a lot of trauma, and I just want to thank her for being part of it. I know it was so difficult to do, and she did it. She did a great job. And now, without further ado, here is my episode with Willow. Welcome to Narcissist Apocalypse, everyone. With me today, I have Willow. How are you?
I'm doing well, Brandon.
Well, we talked for a while, and we both noticed, or I noticed, that last year you sent me an email. I returned it, and it went to your junk. So it's been a year in the making, but as you said before, it's been a good year in the making because you got a better perspective of what's happened. And I'm happy you're here, and unfortunately you're here, and I know you're going to help a lot of people. So thank you for being here today, Willow. And without further ado, the floor is now yours.
I can't believe the floor is now mine. It's so exciting for it to be my turn. Okay, well, one, I said it before, but I'll say it on air. Like, thank you for running this platform and sharing people's stories. It saved my butt massively, and is just so powerful and validating and educational, mainly to like see patterns and through what other people have lived through. So that is a huge gift, and so I just really want to thank you for that. So my story, I'm gonna give a little bit of context before I get into the adventure coming of age adventure that was a year of my life. So I'm Canadian. I live in New York, but I'm a Montrealer, and I grew up in a house that, you know, I had parents who were educated and loving and like flawed humans, but not in any way that is radical or trauma inducing. I was a happy, happy kid, have a younger brother. When I became a teenager, I developed a really bad eating disorder. And that sort of, you know, like I did well at school. I am very creative. Like I've always been sort of, you know, into whatever it was I was working on, but this eating thing had like followed me through my adult life and was like really problematic and sort of, I would say, like stunted my growth in many ways, because like many addictions, it just kind of took all the space. I think as a consequence, I always told myself I didn't want kids, because that is not the sort of thing that one entertains having children with if, you know, you're not a total jerk. So, you know, I went to college. I had a long-term relationship. I moved back to Montreal. I worked in advertising. I'm a creative director, so I worked in advertising for a very long time there. And then I started working on my eating. I had a burnout at work, started working on my eating, and I actually went to AA to work on my eating because I liked the 12-step model. I'd done rehabs, I'd done groups, I'd done all the stuff, but I went to AA, and I met my ex-husband there. That was not the right person for me to marry. He was a lovely human, but just like, he liked watching SportsCenter at night. It was not the right fit, you know? He's my family. I love this man to the tits, but I should not have married him. I was relatively young. I was like 27 with maturity level of an 11-year-old. And it took me a couple of years to realize like, it really isn't working. There were a whole bunch of reasons that it wasn't working. That don't really matter here, but I didn't know how to get out. And, you know, I sort of had segued out of advertising a year after we got married. We were working together. I went to India to run this program for street dogs. And while I was there, I took an interview at this agency, big agency in India, in Delhi. And was offered a job, and I decided to take it. And my ex-husband at the time, being an absolute mensch, was like, I have your back. Like, we'll work it out. Maybe I spend 6 months there, 6 months here. Like, go. This has been on your bucket list. Go, go. I went to boarding school in India. Like, I have a legacy in India, so it wasn't that strange. So I moved to India, and in my gut, I kind of know that I'm going there to see how I feel. Like, am I going to miss him? Am I not going to miss him? And I don't really miss being married, which is inconvenient because I don't like hurting people's feelings. and I don't really know how to deal with this. And I do it the worst possible way, which is like, let's just set off a nuclear bomb in one's life. Let's just have an affair and drink too much and work 90-hour weeks and like let's just blow the world up. So I'm doing that, and I'm with this young Indian that I work with, he's a jerk. He's not a narcissist. He's just an entitled brat who gets really abusive when he's drunk. But my marriage dissolved. My ex-husband is really devastated. I am fairly self-loathing for how I did this. It isn't that I did that leaving was wrong, but the way I left is wrong. Anyway, that all falls kind of like, you know, balls in or out of place. And this agent scam ad in India is a mess. We decide to move to New York. So we get a job in New York from Delhi, move to Manhattan, get a place. And this guy, like I said, he's a dick. And everyone knows it. And eventually he's fired from work, which is the best thing that could possibly happen to me. And I take about a year to steady the ship. I buy my ex-husband buys my house in Montreal. I buy a place in New York. I'm at this agency that like I'm doing well at. Things are finally, for the first time in a long time, stabilizing. I have my eating really more under control than I ever have in my life. And I'm like, oh, okay, things are getting better. And I meet a man and I date him for a year and I adore him. And he ends up breaking up with me because he says, and you know, who knows if this is a thing, but like he's like, you know, I want a family and whatever. And like when I sent you photos of babies, you were like, never send me those again. And I was like, well, they weren't my baby. Like I don't want to see other people's babies and feign interest. Like I don't care. But I realized like I haven't really been considering some of the things that matter to me and that I want in my life. And we break up and I'm heartbroken. And I'm also really just feeling very empty at work, you know, like I'm working on Fortune 500s and it's fun and whatever, but I feel like I'm not really having the impact that I want and I'm not inspired in the way that I want to be. And I speak to my work and I decide to take a year to do what I'm calling a free-range creative. Supposed to be a year where I would like go off and like work in an elephant village and do, you know, and do ayahuasca and like all the cliche eat, pray, love shit. And I'm working with this man in LA who his father wrote Year to Live, and like I've got a mentor in this process, and I'm kind of stoked, you know. I'm like, I'm gonna put my house on the market and rent it out so that I can travel while I do this year. And like there was this, you know, Noah Harari had this quote, he said, you know, like if you want it, the truth doesn't lie at the center, it lies at the periphery. You have to be willing to waste time and walk the periphery if you want to find real insight and real truth. I was like, bam, I'm going to go do that. Mama likes that idea. So like my work is like, fine, like we got your back. Go, have fun. Like, you know, go save the whale. And I go on a trip with my parents. They had booked a thing to Mexico for the family. So we all go down to Mexico and I'm starting to, you know, like I'm very casually dating. Basically, I'm just like, you know, I'm having like, you know, a date here, sleep with this person here, but like very just nothing serious because I know I'm going to be ejecting. And I start talking to this man, and he's interesting. And when I get back to New York, I like hit him up to go meet, and he doesn't want to meet. And I like convince him to go for a meal. And he's different. He is charismatic as hell. He's incredibly intelligent. He's challenging. And, you know, like we've been talking for a week or so, like pretty intensively while I was away. And like, I'm just really fascinated by him. He has a legacy in terms of work that I find really inspiring. He has, you know, he's run agencies that did prophetic creative. He ran a fashion label that was really visionary and sustainable and ahead of its time. he's like a strategist, a futurist. He has big, sexy, visionary kind of ideas. Like, all of this is just pornography for me. And, you know, we sleep together and the sex is ridiculous. Like, I was like, what's up with this? You know, like, whoa, I was sort of just shocked. And he knew what my plan was in terms of my year, And the next day he goes home in the morning and he calls me around lunch and he's like, get your bag. I'm picking you up. I want to take you somewhere. So he, you know, I meet him downtown and he takes me to this beach that's called Dead Horse Bay, which is like this kind of magical beach, like 40 minutes out of the city where like all the horse water houses used to be. And the tide has sort of eroded these burial sites and dump sites essentially from like 100-150 years ago. And the beach is just covered in like glass and marbles and old spoons and horse bones, and it stings. And I took mushrooms before I went. So I was like, this is magic. I'm losing my shit. And it was just, and he was like, you know, you don't need travel all over the place and like whatever to find the periphery. Like, the periphery is here if you want it. And he had a way, right? Like, he just had a way. And I started spending a lot of time with him, and he was working on this trade show that was going to be like for sort of future of outdoor that was taking place in Germany at this big trade convention. And that was also like fascinating and interesting. So there was all this stuff that was like really enticing to me. It was like intelligence, beauty, art, culture, all the things together, sex. Shit, I'm in trouble. And I knew I was in trouble. At the same time, he's like totally broke because he's in startup mode, which I don't really care about, frankly. He had this daughter who was very young. She was 5. And he was in all these legal disputes with his daughter's mother. And he started laying on sort of his personal drama really fast and really thick. And it was just like this intensity of drama that scared me out the gate. I was like, this is like, whoa. And I started pulling back. And I'm not sure exactly how it went down, but he rejected me as a consequence. He was like, you know, like, I guess he was like, I'm a package deal, whatever. Or like, I don't want to play games. Like, I'm being upfront. And like, and so this rejection was just reverse psychology 101, which is something that I didn't really know triggered me quite as effectively as it does. But I went back to him and,
so to explain that, if the thing was on your terms, it would be different. But when you got rejected, you felt rejected. So then you, let's say, wanted to caretake that or prove yourself.
Maybe I don't even know, Brandon, what it was. Is that about my self-esteem? Is that about like wanting what I can't have? I'm not sure what it was that did it, but I like it. I wanted to have the option, you know, like I wanted to make a decision. Now he was making the decision and part of me didn't like that. So I went back and right away I'm introduced to his daughter. And which is strange, right? Like, because I've literally known this man, like, in terms of face-to-face knowing him for maybe a week and a half, 2 weeks. But I meet his daughter, and, like, she's a munchkin. She's adorable. He lives in Brooklyn. And I start staying over there. You know, I get there's like, we go through now sort of the phase of like mirroring, paradise phase, like all the things I'm confiding. And I'm incredibly trusting, which I like about myself. And maybe it's because I'm Canadian. Maybe it's because I'm idealistic. Maybe it's because I'm stupid, but I'm super, super trusting. And he's telling me stories, and the stories are, there are many red flags in the story. There's the fact that, like, you know, he has no photos of his ex-wife and can't find one. Because I was like, who is she? Like, show me a photo. Can't find one. All of his exes are crazy. The last two women he had serious relationships with both had abortions while they were with him. He, you know, has been screwed out of millions of dollars by his ex. Like, he was abused as a kid by his parents. Like, it's victimization. It's like the sob story. It's really, and I buy all of it because I trust people. Like, why would you lie about things that make your life sound so shitty? I couldn't understand why any of this could possibly potentially be a lie. So where am I? You know, I'm super naive. I'm going along with all of this. He's like working on this project, and because I'm working part-time at the agency and Free Range Creative, I start helping with this venture, and it's cool. Like, and I have a really hard time also differentiating between like loving a person and loving their work. Like, if something is beautiful, if someone makes something beautiful, I assume that person is beautiful. There are a lot of crossed wires that to me are like, these things are synonymous or interchangeable, but they're not necessarily. So, you know, we're plugging along on this, and the intensity is very high in all respects. Now, I have had, since I broke up with my ex, I'm consuming zero substances. I have not, my eating has been perfect for the longest that it has ever been. Like, I have struggled with my eating my entire life, and I really like took sort of that heartbreak as, I guess, a moment where I, you know, like, love and heartbreak are really good fuel sources. That's what my ex used to say, and I tend to agree. And so I was like, do not waste this burn, you know, like, transformation, please. So I've got this time under my belt that's unprecedented for me, literally since puberty, in terms of my self-care. And I'm really proud of that. Like, I'm really profoundly sort of touched by that, because it was so untenable for me. So we're, you know, I'm basically like staying in Brooklyn. I get this realtor, you know, she's looking to rent out my house, which costs a freaking fortune. And he starts confiding in me stories that are like, oh, kind of stories. Like, he was in style. Now, let's just put a pin in this, because literally my education of like all things intelligence community is like Nikita. That is, and I'm like, what the fuck do you mean you bring style? And like stories of like, you know, being in the Middle East and bombing things and killing people and like, and to poaching missions. And like, I'm just like, what the hell is this? And at the same time, like, this is so beyond the realm of almost reason. And at the same time, here is a person who has, you know, who has a PhD, who has like massive press, who has photos of him with like all of these like incredible artists, musicians, celebrities, etc., who has done amazing things. And I'm like, okay, right? Like the world is a surprising fucking place. Okay. Like, didn't see it coming, but okay.
So at this point, is it fair to say that you are already hooked into this guy, and no matter what he's going to say or do after, you know, the hooks are already in you, that, you know, you are so, you know, taken by his character of his job, character as a person. The nerd in you appreciates all of the things, such as being a futurist and all those kind of magical things. Everything that he's done is just a very impressive kind of guy. There's no and, you know, he also plays the victim. You know, you're kind, even though it's drama to you, you know, see him, he has a child, there's a family aspect to him. You know, what could be wrong here?
I think I'm like 85% there. And then there's the first real fight. And I think actually the first real fight and the process of like going through that fight cycle and how it affected me is what hooked me. And it was like a so obscure kind of fight. Like with the exception of like that one affair that I had on my husband that I regret enormously, like I'm an incredibly loyal person and I'm an incredibly honest person. And which gets me into probably a fair amount of trouble. But I was at his house, and when I had met my narc, I was, like I said, I was casually like dating. There was one other man I was dating, and he sort of found out about this, and he went downstairs. I was taking a bath. He went downstairs, and he came back up. And I was on my phone. I was like on Instagram or something. And he twisted me doing literally nothing into like, this was the most meaningful moment for him. He had just professed feelings for me and I clearly didn't care. And like, he was just like one of many. And like, this wasn't what he was looking for. I was so taken aback by this. It seemed almost like I was like, there must be a misunderstanding. Literally none of this makes sense. And his intensity of feeling in this was like way unmeasured. And it turned into this massive thing where there were accusations and he wanted to see my phone. And there was like, you know, just like a hot festival of word salad that kept me up until like 5 a.m. And at the end, I was like apologizing for God knows fucking what. And that was like, he won a thing. And I don't know how, but at the end of it, I felt like I had done something wrong. And I felt like I was on the defensive somehow. And I think that that was when he really had the reins at some level. I don't know if that makes sense, but that's sort of how it felt. At the same time, these are very clear freaking flags, right? But like, okay, it's all in this medley of like, okay, well, that's fucked up and that's fucked up and that's fucked up, but then this is amazing and this is amazing and this is like mind blowing. And so like, okay, you take the good with the bad, like we can work with this. We wanted periphery, keep going. So, you know, and he's got like this treehouse out in the woods in the Catskills, and we rescue turtles in Chinatown and drive them up the treehouse to let them go in the lake, and we're planning Germany, and it's exciting, and he has beautiful ideas, and basically I never leave and go back home. Okay, like this is like Paradise Phase chapter one. Great. And then, you know, through all of this, this is where sort of the math begins to slip. Like there's still all this goodness. We're meeting artists and designers and going on road trips and like I'm being exposed to sort of facets of culture that I didn't know about. And I introduced him to my work because I see synergy in terms of like what we're working on and what he's doing and the clients that we have. And I work at WPP, like it's not a nothing thing. But I bring him into my work and infiltration real soon. And there start to be a few issues. Like he talks a huge amount, but he doesn't do a lot of work. And I'm paying for everything. And at the same time, like I'm somebody who, like work has always been my baby. Like that's the thing that, and when I say work, it's more making, of creating. And I'm finding it very, very difficult to create around him. And I'm basically living with him. There's no structure. There's no routine. He takes up all of the space, you know? And when I want to leave, like he calls constantly, there are these little flares of jealousy of like needing to FaceTime, almost as confirmation of where I am. And there are these like fights that sort of manage to keep me up all night very frequently. So I'm kind of exhausted and fuzzy, and all of this is textbook, but I haven't read that textbook at this stage.
So when he is getting your location all the time, you're having an argument over it, or do you just get tired of the accusation or the runaround of that and just say like, this is where I am?
Like I'm, you know, I like have to go into the office for a client thing because I'm still in the city. And also because Brandon, like I'm a person who's actually quite solitary. Like I want some privacy. I want some alone time, and I want to do what I'm doing well. And I can't do it well around him because he takes up all the space. So I'm escaping to work basically. And I'm not so clear yet that I'm escaping because it hasn't gotten so bad yet. But I have the need to leave. And whenever I leave, though, there seems to be a fight that comes out of that. And, you know, I'm being conditioned fairly quickly that, like, leaving, I pay for leaving. Right. And so slowly, slowly, like, you know, whether it's going to work or wanting to spend even a night at home, which is like a 15-minute like skate. I skate everywhere, skate to the office versus an hour to get in from his place. I start to just like shrink my world and avoid those things to avoid conflict. And I'm not clear that this is, and this is happening fast. This is all like a month, let's call it a month and a half. Like it's very, it's rapid. So, you know, I'm, and we're planning this Germany thing together, and I'm going to go with him and run this show. And like, I'm designing sort of this airplane terminal sized event of like the future of outdoor, and it's dope. And like I have a full plate, and so, you know, and he's stressed and all the things. So like I kind of let things go also, but I don't really notice how small my world is becoming and that I'm being isolated while it's happening. And he's still not really working. I have to be there every second weekend. He has his daughter. I have to be there every time his daughter is there, which is strange and inappropriate. But suddenly that's like part of my responsibility. And I am infatuated with him. And it seems reciprocal. And I've never had a partner who was emotionally present and not emotionally avoidant. And it's lovely at that level, you know, like it's, I'm sort of drunk on the intensity of all of it. But there start to be like, there begin to be these really concerning sort of pieces of information that I discover. Like he has these, and these, you can take this as big or small. He has dogs. They're kind of neglected. He literally never walks his dog. He threatens his ex-wife, like who has his daughter. Like he threatens her. He's litigious with her. He is like storing evidence on her. He's trying to hack her. He talks about, you know, she was an addict like decades ago. He talks about like using his connections and hitting her with heroin in the street because he knows that it would be what's best for his kid. Like. Oh, sweet mother of pearl, this is not what normal humans do kind of thing, right? He kind of, you know, he talks about his father apparently was horrific to him, but and he claims to, like, love his mother, but he also, like, sort of uses his mother and, like, uses her financially. Like, he doesn't treat her like he loves her. He treats her like he uses her. And he starts also sort of changing me slowly but surely. There's criticism about the way that I work, the way that I dress, who my friends are, my relationship with my family. And I've disclosed things to him at this stage. Like he knows my secrets. He knows my weaknesses. He knows about he knows about me. He knows about my ex. He knows my life. Like it's been full open book, full disclosure up until now, you know?
And the person that you met initially, all of those things, you're starting to see that it is a false front, even though you may not be... Or maybe have it on the back burner, but it's in your mind now that maybe these things aren't adding up, but you're in it. And are you in denial?
There are like flickers of like, ooh, like that's not cool. Like that doesn't match. But at the same time, there was all of this evidence that sort of substantiated a bunch of the stuff that he had told me. And like they say that the best lies are the lies that like are based on a kernel of truth. So I think he understood that. I think he understood how to take certain elements from his past that were real, and I'll get into which they were later, and build upon them to manufacture a narrative that is by and large false, but that if you believe those few initial things, like you would believe the whole story, you know? And so like this is going on, there starts to be more like behavior that I'm really sort of, you know, like he goes into my computer and looks through my photo album and flags things. And I'm like, you can't do that. Like, that's an invasion of privacy. Like, don't you know that you don't do that? And then there's this like chronic sort of insecurity, let's call it, which is really jealousy, which is really control, which he blames on his ex cheating on him, where he wants to look in my phone constantly. And when he finds things in there that are embarrassing in some way, he uses them against me. And, you know, when the fights or whatever, he'll, like, make it so, it's so twisted. He would, like, make me share things with him. He would make me, like, have sex with him and share things with him, and basically, like, turned these, like, vulnerable, relatively insignificant pieces of information, but things that to me felt embarrassing, and he knew how to read me. He would use them to shame me, and he would do it in the construct of, like, a sexual context. And that was, like, a kind of kink that was, like, not my kind of kink. That was, like, I'm all for exploring all the food groups, but that was, like, I don't like how this feels. This feels humiliating in a really shitty, shitty way. And he enjoyed that. And so that was pretty disconcerting. And that kind of behavior over the course of the relationship escalated. And it didn't escalate in the way that, like, you know, he was never violent with me. He was violent around me, but he was never violent with me. But he would use sex and punishment and shame and mix them together into a soup and make me eat it. And that was, you know, I ended up towards the end, like, just disassociating when this happened and basically giving up, like giving in and giving up and just not being there for it because I didn't really know what else to do. So obviously I tell no one about this because it's fucked up and shameful, and then they'll hate him and they'll say, why are you with him? And I can't justify it, so I don't tell anyone. And anyway, I'm not really talking to anyone, and I'm supposed to be doing a year to live, and I'm, you know, all the things. So I start journaling kind of in secret. Like, I've got, like, a hidden Instagram account, and I like write stuff and take photos, and it's not like a log of bad things that are happening. It's just a place to, like, talk to myself, at least it feels safe. And even doing that, like, there was this tinge that I knew was there that I didn't really lean into, but it was, like, a sense of fear of him finding things that I had said that would upset him and being punished for it. So, like, the need to hide stuff. So I knew something was wrong at that level, and, you know, but we left for Germany. We had this trade show to do, and we're like, what, like maybe 3 months in, we're in Germany and we're doing this, like, really cool thing. And I feel like I'm sort of, like, getting to look into sort of, like, worlds and opportunities that I had not been exposed to before. And that's really, really cool. And, like, I'm doing a really good job also, which I enjoy. And at the same time, like, there are these fights. He's like, he's given me full, I'm in charge of, you know, I'm in charge of the space, I'm in charge of design. And that part is, like, super validating because I respect his work. I respect that he's pulled this thing off also. And at the same time, he, like, you know, he's picking fights, like, professional fights at this trade show with, like, big, like corporations, like CCOs, and like kind of showing up almost like in this gangsterish way and threatening people. And I'm like, what is this? And he's picking fights with me, and it's always an ultimatum, and I always end up, like, giving in because there's no compromise. There's no room for conversation. It's either it's over or I come back to him. And we're in a fight one day, and, you know, like, we've left the event at the end of the day, and we're in Munich, and, like, he's just being horrid. We're walking down the street, and he wants to go to the red light district. You know, he'd been talking about us having threesomes while we were there. He's talking about us, like, sleeping with sex workers while we're there. And like, again, I have no issue against, like playing with in any capacity, but I have issues doing this when I'm fighting with my partner. Like, this is not an aphrodisiac for me. This is not, like, a moment where I'm feeling amorous or adventurous or any of it. And I'm like, no, like, no, no. And he, like, you know, throws water in my face, and it, like, it's, everything is just, yo, you're a dick. Like, you're just being a real jerk at a level that I don't quite know how to process. The trade show ends. We decide to, and, like, bear in mind, you know, I've put in a bunch of money for this. My ticket was paid for, et cetera, but, like, he has no cash, blah, 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 blah. Like, it's held together a little by a shoestring. And we decided to take, like, a week and just putz around the Alps. And what do you know? I'm late getting my period. And I'm 38 at the time. I'd never had a pregnancy. Like, I've never been pregnant. I've never tried to get pregnant. This is incredibly irresponsible, capital I underlined in italics, right? Like, oh, sweet Jesus. I've known this human for, like, 3 months. And, right. Well done. So, and he's, like, happy about this. We're driving around. I'm nauseous. I'm low energy. I don't really want to be going on adventures, like trekking up to the Mad King's castle and whatever. Like, I'm not feeling fantastic, but, we sort of follow his agenda, and it's this, like, combination of, I love him and I hate him, and I love this and I hate this, and I want to go home, and this is home, and it's a hot mess, and I don't really know which way is up. We do that. I go home to New York with him. I pee on a stick. I'm pregnant, obviously, right? And I tell myself, okay, what's the worst case scenario here? Because, like, we can be stupid, and then we can be stupid. And I'm like, the worst case scenario is the probable scenario at some level, statistically, which is, like, this may not work. You don't know a person after 3-4 months. So if this does not work, then can I do this? Do I want this? And I was like, yeah, I actually really want this. And that was like a revelation, because, like I said at the beginning, I had never even entertained that that was something that was viable for me, you know? But I feel like solid. And so I'm home. I haven't told anybody. We are supposed to be leveraging, like, all of the work opportunities, et cetera, that came out of Germany, but he isn't really working. He's actually not working at all. He has no money. He's not working. I guess I'm nervous, Brandon. Like, part of starts getting nervous because I'm pregnant. He's always like, he's months late on rent. He hasn't paid child support. He's not using all of these opportunities. I'm pregnant. Right? Like, yo, buddy, buckle up. Like, like this is the moment now where we get ducks in a row. This is New York. This requires some like planning and strategy and like a game plan and money and all the things. And I'm not seeing that. And that's really impacting how I start to feel. And I feel like I'm stuck in this truck with this, you know, maybe my baby kind of thing. And he's driving me nuts and he's not doing anything. And I miss my home. I miss my work. I miss a sense of freedom. I miss a sense of agency. I miss security. Like there start to be like these feelings that I can't really ignore. And so I call my realtor and I take the house off the market. Okay. Like nothing won, nothing lost, nothing's changed. Fine. But this becomes a very big point of contention, obviously. Because that's my exit. That's also a big chunk of money that every month I'm not paying rent with him. I'm paying my mortgage. And, so I, you know, I might be like supporting his lifestyle in a bunch of ways, but I can't really be paying for his life while I'm paying for this place. And you know, as sort of the pregnancy goes on, like I become really sensitive to smells and to all the normal stuff. And like his house is filthy. Like his dogs piss everywhere because he never trained them because he knows the life of them. And like, I feel sick. Like I can't, like I can, like I can't deal with it. And so we fight about that and I leave and we make up and rinse, wash, repeat, rinse, wash, repeat, rinse, wash, repeat. But it's wearing on me. And while all this is happening, he's planning sort of like our lives together and our work lives together. And he's looking at homes in the woods that I assume he wants me to buy. Like, no. And you know, and all of this, Brandon, the thing that was wacky is like, I'm pretty sure it's verbatim what happened with both women who came before me. Like, he wanted to get places out in sort of, you know, like Woodstock or the Catskills. He wanted, like, he knocked them up early, like, they worked with him. Like, this is not a unique, I am not a privileged candidate in the scheme of things. This is modus operandi. And I'm aware of that. And the things he's accusing me of, it's all projection of like either things that they've done or things that he's done, probably things he's done. And I'm not happy. I'm really feeling really anxious. Really, really anxious and really controlled. Really anxious and really controlled. And there, even though he hasn't threatened me yet, I've seen how he's acted with everyone around him. And so I know, you know, I know how he operates. And so I think that there's concern there that's justified also, that's just at a gut level. So, and I don't have vices. He's controlling how much I exercise. Like, movement has always been a big part of sort of how I make myself feel good. Like, whether it's yoga or whether it's skating or whether it's whatever, like a movement practice is important. He's being really controlling about that. He's being really controlling with my food, like making me eat certain things, being controlling with work. And so, and I'm not eating, like I'm not binging and purging. I'm not drinking. I'm not, I have no tools. I have no vices. And so I start sleeping as a way to, and I have no work, which has always been like, okay, I can make, and there's silence when I make things in my head. But I can't do that either. And so I start sleeping as a way to escape, because it seems like the only place, the thing I can do that's like good for the baby, and also where he'll shut the fuck up, you know? So we decided to go to Canada to introduce him to my parents before my birthday. And we drive up there, and like, my parents are academics. Like, they know an academic when they see one, I guess. Anyway, we drive up there and we fight the whole time, and I fake sleep in the car and blah, blah, blah. And we go to the cottage, and my father and he go out for like these long canoe rides where, you know, the narc, my narc, talks incessantly. And there's a lot of jealousy that's starting to come up about my ex-husband, who is, like I said, family. Like, it has been platonic 1,000% since we separated. He has a girlfriend, but the fact that he's in my life is a really big problem. Is a really big problem. And I don't want to tell my parents that I'm pregnant yet. I feel like they just met this man and we're fighting and I'm not happy. And I don't want to tell them this while I'm not happy. And because they'll know, because they can read me. And while I'm there, I ask my mother, I go into the kitchen. Everybody's having dinner on the porch, and I go into the kitchen and I say to her, can you ask me to come back like soon just to like spend time with you guys? And she's like, yeah, come back. And I'm like, no, can you ask me out there? And she looks at me funny, and she does. And after she knew. She sat down with my father, and she's like, something is really not right. Like, something is very, very wrong here. So we go back to New York, and on the way back, we make up, and we're back in paradise, and it's ridiculous. And go back to the city, his father gets sick, and his father, who he hates, and I tell him I want to spend a couple of nights a week at my place. And we get in like massive fights about this, because he really doesn't like me having that place at all. But you know, I'm staying in the city. His father gets sick. I just thought to go back to see my parents. He kind of makes up with me before I leave. I go back to Kent. I take the train back home, and I tell my parents I'm pregnant, and they're thrilled. Okay, they're beyond. They're like, you're absolutely the stupidest person on planet Earth, and also we're so, so, so happy, and whatever you need, we've got you. And I sort of start telling them, you know, like, I tell them a little bit about the sort of, like, house issues and blah, blah, blah. And my father's like, no, like, look, you are pregnant. You are working downtown. This is stable income. He needs to bend to you. Like, there has to be compromise in this equation. And this is actually about like reducing the amount of stress physically, etc., right now, like, enough. If you want, I'll speak to him. His father died. Like, okay, go home. On the way home, I tell him that this was a conversation. And World War III erupts. And the next day, I was supposed to go in for an ultrasound. I show up at the doctor, and he's waiting for me. And he asks to see my phone, not like to look in it. Takes my phone, and he deletes our entire chat history. We're in the waiting room. And I was like, and I didn't think of it at the time as evidence. I thought of it as like history and also like not yours to do. And I was like, what the fuck? We go into the doctor. We're doing my exam. I'm healthy. The baby's healthy. Everyone's fine. And then he pulls out that, you know, I have like this unstable psych history, and, you know, he's very concerned about my emotional stability and the well-being of this baby. And he says, you know, like when I was 18, there was a doctor who said that I might be borderline, which I was never diagnosed with. But he tells this doctor this, and she gets very concerned, but none of it is true. Like, I'm the most stable I've ever been, and like, what? So I leave, and she's really concerned, and she's now responding like, this is fact. And we leave there, and he calls my parents, and he tries to align them with him, like, you know, that he's very concerned and da, da, da. And my parents are like, no, like, we know how she's doing. Like, stop it. And he calls my ex-husband. He tries to do the same. My ex-husband, again, like people have my back. They know me. They trust me. We have a, like, very, usually very good communication.
So here's an instance where he is trying to, you know, everything that's kind of going on, he's, you know, you're in a situation where you're feeling trapped. He's pulling all the shenanigans. He's not the same person as when it started. The facade is crumbling. And here's...
The mask is slipping.
It's slipping. Yeah, and here's a point where he's now going to try and put you further in a hole by creating a smear campaign, everyone against you. But unbeknownst to him... it's not going to work because your parents know you like the back of your hand. And if there's any fault in what he's doing as a, in whatever pathology, you know, he has and whatever plan he has, this is his first misstep, would you say?
Yes, this is a massive, this is what destroyed any, it would have all gone to hell in a handbasket anyway, obviously, but this was the stupidest thing he did, because then when he didn't get his way, what did he do? He lashed out. And he lashed out not at me, he lashed out by threatening my parents through me. And he'd gone on all these canoes, like, my father's an economist, he's, you know, clever with his investments, etc. And I believe, but bear in mind, I believe that this man is ex-psyop and has murdered people, okay? And so, and super connected and all of this shit. And so he under the guise of being concerned for the well-being of this baby, his baby, I quote, he starts threatening my parents, and I'm shocked. Like, I'm shocked. Like, nobody has ever threatened me or my family. And, you know, he's threatening them. It escalates. He breaks windows. He breaks doors. He won't let me out of the house. It, like, turns from, you know, we were at, like, 60 on the Richter scale of dysfunction to like, oh no, we're all the way there where like I am now scared. And I leave and am sort of in shock, and you know, somehow he talks his way out of or justifies all of that somehow, and I'm now in a real bind because everybody has seen, because I've spoken to them, I've called them, I've been worried, I've been like, I told them what I'm scared of, that he's threatened, right? Like, so now they have seen who he is. And everybody is now, so my ex-husband is a serious interventionist, like he knows crazy when he sees it, and he's like...
And just to say, your ex-husband, your first husband, you were actually married to.
Yeah, correct. So everybody is like, and my parents sit down with my ex-husband and they're like, something's really not adding up here. We need a PI. So they hire a PI. Now I'm now in this shit place where I am hearing about this conflict with my parents and my ex-husband from my narc constantly. And it's really devastating to me because I'm not going to cut these people out. Like that's not even in the realm of on the table. But I'm in the middle of like this massive conflict and I don't know how to broker a peace deal. And you know, my nurse starts talking about paternity contracts and all this stuff. I start having panic attacks, which I've never had in my life. And like, I'm really worried about what kind of a environment my body is for this kid. Beyond like the future, I'm like, what kind of a garden is this, because it feels toxic as shit to me, you know, like I'm so stressed and so unhappy and like scared. I've never been scared like the way that he's scaring me.
So what did your parents find with the PI?
We're getting there, Brent. Okay. We're getting there. So I go to I have a shoot for work in London for like 3 weeks. So I go to London. We have sort of semi made up. He's shopping, you know, for engagement rings. I don't freaking know. And my father tells me I've hired this PI and maybe you're going to hate me for it, but if something happens and I didn't do anything, I would never forgive myself. So you can hate me. And I'm like, no, I understand that. Fair enough. Do the shoot. Fine. I come home and like the break was a relief, obviously, right? It's like, I'm away. I'm not being guilted for being away. I can breathe like, whew. I come home and have the genius idea of telling my nurse that my parents hired the PI.
Oh, that was a really bad. That was a really bad idea.
You think? Oh my god!
I never usually say anything like that on the show, but I'm going to say right now that was a terrible idea.
A terrible idea. Terrible idea. So, and and what does the PI find out? So the PI comes over and finds out that he does not have a PhD. He has multiple orders of protection out against him. He has multiple lawsuits out against him. He is not, has no history whatsoever of being anything government, Secret Service, anything, and those people don't talk about it. It's like, just lie after lie after lie after lie. And I'm like, okay. Okay. Fuck. Now, where am I? So I'm spending more and more time at my house. Because, you know, this came up. I'm spending a few days a week there. I'm in Brooklyn one day, and something happened, and I had been waiting for Brandon. And I wait for him to leave. I get my cat. I pack a small bag of stuff, and I go home. And like the cat was a thing. Like the cat was like, I'm not going to leave my cat. And, you know, I start to think seriously about what my options are, because like the threats are escalating now. And, I think at this stage he comes over, there's maybe one or two more Hoovers. He came over one day and like, he wouldn't leave. He's like, you know, ringing the doorbell endlessly, like sitting outside my house, finally let him in and like, won't shut up, won't leave. And like, I'm like, I'm hitting walls. Like, I feel hunted. I feel trapped and hunted. And like, I feel incredibly fucking unstable, actually. And I end up going to emergency because like, I don't know what else to do. And, I'm there. They know I'm pregnant. They know the statistics also. And this is what shocked the shit out of me, because like, they know the statistics in terms of like abuse and pregnancy and all the things. And they're like, can we talk to him? And the doctor, the psychologist calls him. This is an Upper East Side hospital. Talk to him for an hour, and they're like, he really wants to make things better with you, and they send me home with him, and like, rinse, wash, repeat. And it, you know, the last straw was we went for a drive, and he wanted to go look at houses that he couldn't pay for, and we go for this drive, and on the way home, something happens, and he starts eating the car like he's gonna crash it into things. And I'm like 4 months pregnant and I'm petrified, and I jump out of the car, it's still moving, and I can't even go back to my house because he's parked outside of it. And I get this, I don't even have a key to his house after all of this. And that was it. The next day I called a lawyer, and I sent him groceries before I called the lawyer, but you know, whatever. So I call a lawyer. I go down to see this man and in financial district, and I tell him the story, and I say, what do you think and what should I do? And he said, well, I think you should have an abortion. And you may want to change your name. And if you can move without it being hugely inconvenient, you should probably do that. And if you want, often we're hired to plant bait. And I was like, pardon? Come again? What was that? And he's like, yeah, like plant a new supply. And I was like, what happened to the bait? And he's like, the same thing that just happened to you. And I was like, you offer this as a service? And he's like, yes, that's the safest way of moving on. And I was like, walked out of that office, mind a little bit blown, and went to my friend's house, ate a lot of Chinese food and cried for a day, and called my doctor and said, I think I need to terminate this pregnancy because I don't think that knowing, you know, what the laws are, that there's any way that I can keep this person out of my life. And I don't want to be in the swamp, or for this baby to be in a swamp in perpetuity, because he will want to be there, because that will be supply. And my parents are barely beside themselves. I go to, my ex-husband flies down with my ex-sister-in-law to be with me. I book an appointment at the doctor and go in, and they explain the procedure, and I'm like, really? Like, this is how we do this in 2020? Like, dismemberment, is there not a better way of doing this? And there's like, they were like, actually, like, if we reschedule, we can, there's like a more ethical means of abortion where we, like, you know, like, stop the heart ahead of time. And I'm like, yeah, I'll take that way, please, obviously. My parents fly down, and my father is, like, they book lawyers. He's looking for, like, holes in the fence. And at the same time, he's like, I have your back no matter what. And, you know, during all of this, I, before back up, the PI, after I'd met with the PI, you know, I'd gone to the police and I'd filed, because my ex had started sending threats, not just to me, but to my ex. He had been contacting my ex's girlfriend and telling her lies about us. She had relapsed as a consequence, like hard relapse. He'd called every partner I had had that he knew of and, like, done the mandatory smear. He'd called my boss. I'd had to warn my work. Like, it was, we were in full mode, you know? Legal letters were coming. Like, it was, he'd called my parents and told them every last possible disgusting thing that he could muster that I had told him. And my father laughed and was like, ha, huh, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. And I was like, I have the best fucking family, you piece of human waste. But my parents came down, and I knew it was the right thing to do, and I knew there were no options that were good. And I knew that, like, everything he had threatened, that I had seen him threaten his ex with, would be verbatim what I would go through. And, like, I had a great childhood with solid, like, stable parents who loved each other and loved me. And still I wound up messed up, Brent, right? Like, I'm not going to, like, this child would be so fucked up. Like, what a terrible thing to do to a person. And so my mother stays, and she's a rock. She's, like, usually hyper-emotional, and she's being a fucking rock. And I'm reading The Velveteen Rabbit to my stomach at this stage, trying not to be upset so that, like, the melon that is in me doesn't know that the world is falling apart. And we go in and watch on a big screen as they hunt a heartbeat. And she holds my hand. And I have the procedure and we go home. And that really sucked. And at the same time, like, I don't think I would have left if I hadn't been pregnant. Like, I don't think that if I didn't have to think about, like, the well-being of, and, like, the future in such a way, because I'm not, I'm pretty bad at marshmallow experiment. Like, I don't know if I would have, I don't know if I would have had such a clean break. But that really hurt, like, more than I think anything has hurt me. Because I realized in the process that I would be a really good mother and I really wanted Bentley. And I was also 39. And, you know, like, there are windows. So, and after that, the smear continued, the social smears, all the things. And, you know, like, nobody engaged. I had, like, acquaintances on social that would contact me and say, like, this person is saying this, and, like, that doesn't seem cool. I had ex-partners, one-night stands, whatever, that he would reach out to so they would, like, back me. Like, my ex-husband totally, like, gray rocked the shit out of him. Everyone had my back. You know, I was scared after. I would check my doors. I was vigilant as hell. Because this is not reasonable. None of this was reasonable. The threats were very unreasonable. The order of protection I got extended to my parents, my ex, like, oh, and this is a really lovely piece, actually. The piece before the abortion, before the final straw was, he wanted me to come back to Brooklyn, and I didn't want to. And we had meetings, like work meetings the next day, and he faked a suicide attempt. And his business partner called me at, like, you know, 5 in the morning, was like, you know, he said that he's taken all of this, whatever, whatever. And he's like, and that he's at the treehouse. And I was like, but there's no cell reception at the treehouse. And I was like, that doesn't add up. And so I taxi over to Brooklyn and his truck is there. And his partner had already called an ambulance and he'd been picked up, and I go to the hospital and I say, like, did you check him for insulin? Because he said he took all of his father's insulin. And the doctor was like, one sec. And he's like, yeah, no, his blood is clean. I'm going to take a shit. And while I was there, he tried to turn it on me. He tried to, like, talk about my psych issues, my And they ended up giving him a, like, what is this, 5150 or whatever, like, held against your will for your own protection, and kept him there for, like, a week. And he wanted me to, like, get him out, and I wouldn't. And that was the straw. That was, like, after that, it was, like, war. So, you know, I had this abortion. He tried to... I blocked him on everything. I went back to work almost immediately. I just wanted to, like, put my head down and I wanted to put my head down and go back to normal, I think. And, you know, went home at Christmas that year. And this is, all of this is 2 years ago is when I met him, I think. Is that correct? I think so. I went home and, you know, so I get signed back up full time at work, and literally it had been almost exactly a year. And this is the whole irony of this story, you know, that like I wanted to take a year off to go like feel new things and learn new things and discover something about myself. And careful what you ask for. and he's a miserable, miserable person. I didn't know that that existed as a person. Like I didn't know that malicious existed. Just out of like, you know, pure pleasure in destruction and harm. Like I didn't, that was new, to me. And at the same time, like, this was the first time in my life that I really saw how much I am loved, like really felt how much I'm loved by the people I love. And that was a big gift. Like, that's not something that, I don't think you learn that free. So, and you know, COVID happened sort of that spring, and I was really happy. Like, I was really grateful to have a period of quiet and redundancy, and like normal boring felt like luxury to me and safety. And that is that story.
So in this year, you know, you've had a lot of time to think about what happened, heal from what happened, you know, from when you originally emailed me. You know, it was very fresh back then. So it, within the last year, I mean, what were the biggest ways for you to heal from the trauma of everything? Because you went through, I mean, to deal with him alone was one thing, to deal with the loss of your child is another thing, and everything that went about that. And how has been that process, and what have you had to do to deal with everything, to cope?
I dated someone like a couple of months after. I think I just wanted to clear the deck, and like this human was fine. There was nothing. There's nothing wrong at all about him. But I realized like I really need to be alone for a little bit, for a beat here, and I didn't date for like a good 6-7 months after that, 8 months. I would like to say that it was transformative in all of the ways, and I don't think that that's true. I think like I lost myself in work intentionally, pretty hard. I was grateful for COVID. I also like you know, have had bouts where I've struggled with eating since, and I really wish that wasn't the case. It's okay, but it's like 40 years old. Like, I'm so sick of working on this issue. I started dating someone last summer, and it is very slow moving, slow to the point where I'm like, oh, sweet mother of Jesus. But I also really trust that. I appreciate that.
So can you explain what slow is to you? For the benefit of others as well.
Yeah. There was no love bombing. There was, you know, there's intelligence and there's attraction, there's intensity and et cetera, but there's no moving in, there's no grand plans, there's no future or anything. It's very much like in the moment. And
so you're dating mindfully.
I guess, is that what it's called?
No, like, you know how mindfulness is, you know, being mindful, you're being present in the specific situation, like in that present moment. So you are
like,
just.
And I would take credit for it if I could, but frankly, like, that's much more his nature, and I'm grateful for it because it's setting the pace that I can identify as healthy for me right now.
Yeah, you're enjoying your time together. You are, you know, you have your own life, I assume, apart. And when you're doing that with someone else, you're mindful and present with them, but within your date, you know, so you're just, you know, you're being cautious, but you're making sure that there are boundaries, I assume. And that you're staying on your side of the fence, they're staying on their side of the fence, and, you know, your compliments to each other.
Very much. And it's lovely, actually. Like, it's really incredibly reassuring about, you know, because these things can do a number on you. If you get a few in a row, like, they can just mess up your sense of trust also. And in humanity. And my ex doesn't deserve to destroy my sense of trust in humanity.
And
like,
do you have, I guess, flashbacks of any sort or nightmares or anything like that that maybe sometimes throws you back there? And if you do, how do you deal with that?
I had the most horrific nightmares for a year. They were so insane that I actually recorded. I was being a Jungian therapist and I would record them every morning. And I actually turned it into, like, I threw them all up on an Instagram because I was like, this, like, I'm a creative, but I can't come up with shit that comes close to this, like, on my own. Sleep is messed up. Yeah, it was a horrific nightmares, and I still am hyper reactive around sounds at night when I'm alone. I avoid certain parts of town. And you know, the thing that is unfortunate is that, for example, you know, to anything that I could do that would, you know, I would never use his name publicly. I would never even, when I got an order of protection, like, that was one thing. Then his partner, his work partner, had a similar thing happen. He was threatened, et cetera. And he sent me his new address because the narc moved. And he was like, do you want to let the detectives know where he is? Like, this is his address. And I didn't even want to do that because I didn't want to poke the bear. Like, I didn't want to risk anything possibly coming back to me, any potential retaliation. And I think, like, that's the piece that I find so upsetting when it comes to any sort of abuse, is that the, you know, your willingness to do what is, what would be correct, or what could potentially stop them from repeating this, or warn others from entering into it, put you at risk, and it's too big of a risk to entertain. You know what they're capable of. And so everybody shuts up. And it's why women don't call the cops, right? It's like, I'll take a black eye over retaliation for calling cops. Thank you. So I hate that I'm still scared of him. I really don't like that about myself, but I know I made the right choice. I know that it may have been the only, I may not have kids ever, you know? And if I don't ever, then I'm able to live with that also, because I think that that's better than having a family that grows up in ugliness. It was a very, I feel like that whole experience in many ways, like a coming of age, like it was a eye-opening at the level that, like, shocking, just shocking.
And if you have any words of wisdom or advice for everyone who's listening, what would it be?
Well, I think people who are listening are probably either in something or coming out of something, mostly. And I think maybe this is a privileged thing to say, but I'm going to say it anyway. I think that we don't learn things when things are easy, generally. And I think that if this experience doesn't destroy you, it gives you a really big gift. And, you know, whoever it is that we've been with, they're always going to be miserable. And our experience with them was obviously miserable. And also that gift is incredibly valuable. And for me, it was actually really beautiful. And I'm not going to say it's worth it, but it's close. I would say look for what you got from it.
Well, Willow, from the bottom of my heart, I want to thank you for being here today. No, this was not an easy story for you to tell. It's been a whole year work in progress for you to be here. And I just want to thank you from the bottom of my heart for laying it out there for everyone. I mean, that's not easy what you did today, and you did a really good job. And me and everyone else out here are going to be thanking you for a long time. So from the bottom of my heart, thank you so much, Willow.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me on.
You're welcome. And for everyone who is listening, I hope you have a good night.